access to needed health care, and this helps free up local funds for other uses. We work with the Oregon Department of Transportation
Madam Chairman?
Senator Hartung.
Excuse me, Lynn. regarding the ESDs, you leverage federal Medicaid dollars. So does that show up then as an expenditure in the ESD, the dollars that you leverage and send to them?
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, I would expect that it would indeed show up. What they do is, looking at our budget for 0103, we're going to pay to those education service districts approximately $10 million in other funds, or in total funds. They will in turn reimburse us for the state component of that, which would be about $5 million. There's a 50% match on those particular services. So indeed, I would expect that it would show up in their budgets as a line item, as well as in our budget. Right.
Okay.
The Oregon Department of Transportation, we work with them to help develop transportation brokerages. We have one operating in the Portland area, and we are fast expanding. There is great interest across the state to expand upon that and provide transportation for Medicaid clients to medical services.
Is there some place in the budget that these are all set out as to how much that you're providing versus how much they are contributing?
Madam Chair, it's not specifically broken out that way, but we can go in and identify that for you in terms of the dollars that are being leveraged.
Thank you.
We also work with the Oregon Youth Authority in terms of making sure that Oregon Health Plan benefits are available for children in the care of the Youth Authority. We also leverage some money for them for behavioral rehabilitation services to help at-risk youth stay out of state protective custody. We work with the Oregon Corrections Department. Not only to help ensure parolees have OHP benefits upon release for those who might be eligible, but also we contract with the Oregon Corrections Department through Inside Oregon Enterprises. And so inmates provide services to us or for us in terms of answering providers' billing questions. They man a toll-free line for persons who are interested in applying for the Oregon Health Plan and send out application packets. We also work with the State Commission for Children and Families, and I think that goes to the question that you had asked earlier, Chair Winters, in terms of leveraging some of the local commission dollars for the Healthy Start programs in order to increase the number of families who receive home visits for a first child. Moving on to page 31, we work with the Oregon Health Division and with the county health departments on a number of prevention initiatives. We also work with the tribes and Indian Health Service in order to ensure that tribal members who qualify for the Oregon Health Plan are made eligible and have an opportunity to apply. We work with the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, FEOP, in terms of strategies to help ensure access to health care and coverage for low-income Oregonians. And similarly, we work with the Office for Oregon Health Plan Policy and Research, not only on developing strategies to meet that end, but in terms of health policy research questions. We work with the Oregon Health Sciences University. We collaborate on several research efforts, and we also leverage a significant amount of funds for OHSU to help meet their costs for unsponsored health care. And, of course, the big partner in our program is the Health Care Financing Administration, the federal government. They're a partner in terms of running the Oregon Health Plan Medicaid demonstration, the leverage agreements that they sign up for doing some specific quality improvement projects for Medicare, Medicaid, dual enrollees. And then we also work with safety net clinics, federally qualified health centers, rural health clinics, and contract with them in terms of providing health care, outreach, OHP eligibility, services for low-income Oregonians. And during this biennium, we've done a leverage agreement working with Multnomah County to maximize reimbursement going to federally qualified health centers. With that, I'd like to move to page 32 and talk about some of the activities that we've engaged in terms of controlling costs in the program. The items on this page many of them relate to constraining eligibility benefits, and then I'll go on to some additional activities in the following pages. But back in October of 95, the legislature made the decision that that we should tighten eligibility for the health plan to ensure that we're directing our dollars to those who are most in need. So we moved to looking at income over a three-month period to determine whether or not someone was eligible. We established a $5,000 liquid asset limit for participants. In December of 95, we implemented a requirement that the new eligibles, the expansion eligibles, pay premiums so that they have a personal responsibility for a portion of their health care. In January 96, we implemented a reduction in the benefit package, and we reduced the number of services, the lines on the prioritized list that we cover, by 25 lines. In February of 97, we reduced the coverage by another 3 lines. In July of 97, we instituted a review process within the department to maximize managed care enrollment. In July of 99, coming out of the session, we worked with Adult and Family Services Division to put in place some enhanced residency and income verification processes to further ensure that only those people who were eligible according to our criteria were made eligible for the program. We also increased the number of medical services, including ancillary services, things such as physical therapy and other services that require prior authorization, to make sure that we were only providing services where they were medically necessary. And in January 2000, we instituted, also at the legislature's direction, a further limiting of eligibility by establishing a $2,000 liquid asset limit for participants in the Oregon Health Plan. Moving on to page 33, there is a chart here that we hope graphically illustrates some of our continuous efforts to streamline administration and the control of costs. This compares 1991-93 biennium, which is just before we started the Oregon Health Plan, to the 2001-03 biennium. During that time, 12-year period, you'll see that expenditures will grow 251%. The number of claims that we are processing in terms of payment for medical services will have grown 243%. The eligibles that we are serving will have grown 87%. And then our staff, assuming approval of the policy package, will be less than it was 12 years ago. It's a minus 1%. So we believe we're doing more with in using staff more efficiently as the program has evolved. On page 34, I want to get some more detail of some of the budget control efforts that we've put in place. We've instituted some administrative simplification for our managed care plans, which include streamlining the procedures for their submittal of encounter data, simplified the financial solvency reporting requirements that we have, and we've simplified the reporting for quality control measures. In addition, we've done additional simplification and efficiencies that we put in place. We started enrolling clients on a weekly basis into managed care plans instead of the former once a month. We've moved to revising our administrative rules only twice per year at designated times, to revising our contracts only once per year. We implemented an automated information service which allows providers to electronically verify that a client is eligible and to determine what kind of third-party resources, managed care plan the individual might participate in. And we've also added some features to that system that help reduce the duplication of services. If somebody moved from one plan to another plan, you can now tell whether or not they received glasses in the first plan and know whether or not they're eligible to get a second pair of glasses or has the two-year period expired. We also have put in place a client hotline and a hearings unit in order to provide information and resolve problems for clients early in the process and avoid as much as we can moving to the costly hearing stage. We all...
Chair.
Senator Duncan.
Might be a good time for me to
ask your question.
Ask my question. Yes. Which I'm sure you've been warned about.
Question.
I'm concerned about the general public access. You know, if you live in Madras and you're trying to get through to you, can you get a person, or do you get this I'm away from my desk business, and as I say, oftentimes those people may be using a pay phone, they don't even have a telephone in some cases. Have you folks tried to get into your agency and not using the inner sanctum numbers that you know and so forth, and just pretend like you're a client out there? Have you tried to get into your agency? How difficult is it? We often do that from here, but we won't today, but I use my cell phone and try your agency.
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, I have tried, and sometimes it works better than others. But we have done a number of things to facilitate client access to our agency. Certainly with the 1-800 number that we run through the Department of Corrections, when people are interested in acquiring applications for the Oregon Health Plan. We maintain a lot of statistics about calls and how quickly they're answered, and we have very, very good records there. And if we need to increase the staffing in that program to deal with call volume, we're very readily able to do that. In terms of the client services that we provide directly within OMAP, there have been times when call volumes are high and access is not as we would like. The issue there is coming up with the staff to put on the other end of that phone call. We have tried to think about ways to improve access and to make sure that people are able to reach someone when they need to. And I can provide you with statistics for our client advocate services unit as well, if you'd like to see those.
Yeah, I was going to say in your review and with clients, you know, to their response of how things are going, do you ask that question about access and in a person?
Right. Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, I'm not aware that we do, and I think that's a very good suggestion, and we'd be happy to include that.
Thank you.
Continuing on page 34, we do contract for many of our administrative services. In addition to that, third of our administrative budget that I said was for leveraging, another 20% of our budget, we contract out for those services, making use of both private and public entities to perform functions that are needed to support the program. Some of the examples include, as I had mentioned earlier, the Inside Oregon Enterprises at the Oregon State Correctional Institute. They maintain that provider services hotline, the OHP application center. We also use them to mail printed materials for us, rules, notices, guides. We use William Earhart to do the billing and collection of premiums that are by the expansion eligibles.
What's their rate on collections, and how much debt exists with them?
Madam Chair, the collection rate is about 70% on the premiums. And the federal government, HCFA, required us to have a number of exceptions. Basically, what we do is if someone doesn't make payments, their premiums, when they go to reapply for the Oregon Health Plan, they're not eligible to participate again unless they meet one of the exception criteria that HCFA requires us to have. And so, for example, someone who is been a recipient of domestic violence, or someone who's had a 3-month period of zero income. Those are things that, or they're homeless. Those are some of the exception criteria, and we would go ahead and make that person eligible again, even if they had an arrearage.
What happens to the uncollectible accounts?
Madam Chair, there is no attempt beyond the billing of the client to collect that that amount of money. And I will have to look, but I'm not sure that HCFA would allow us to transfer that. Hirsch may know the answer for that.
Madam Chair, the average premium bill for a family today is a little under $11. So over a 6-month period, you're talking about $66 in premium charges that would be billed out. Lynn is correct that the payment rate is about 70%. And the way it works is that if you get behind in your premiums, you can continue through your current 6-month period of eligibility. But unless you meet one of the exceptions, and there's also an exception for children, but unless you meet one of the exceptions, you can't sign up for the health plan again until your premium arrearage is paid. And I do not think we're doing anything at this point in terms of collections. On an individual basis, it's a fairly small amount of money on a per family basis, and that may have something to do with how cost effective it may be to try and collect it. But I would be happy to find out more about that and get back to you.
Would you find out about that? Because, you know, the bill that required agencies to do a little more diligence, and I think it would be nice to know what the average premiums are, whether or not it's even cost effective to pursue it, kinds of things, and also whether HCFA allows it. And the other piece of it is that if this 30% of uncollectibles, and since we pay a match, does HCFA absorb a piece of that?
Madam Chair,
no.
No, actually, we're fairly fortunate in terms of the agreement we have with HCFA. In some states, they require that they get a share of the premiums paid by clients. In Oregon, we get to keep all of it. It's a direct offset to general fund. And in the 2001-03 budget, that represents a little over $12 million that offsets general fund, and that's at that 70% collection rate.
So we don't want to rattle HCFA's chin.
Not in that respect. Last item on that page is just a reference to another electronic eligibility verification system that's available to providers. Moving on to page 35, we also contract with First Health to process our pharmacy claims at the point of sale. That allows the pharmacy to know right up front as they're filling a prescription whether or not it's an eligible client and how much they're going to be paid for the drug being dispensed. They also prior authorize some drugs looking at whether or not the drug is medically appropriate. We contract...
Excuse me, is there a list of drugs that can or cannot be, that you will or will not pay for?
Madam Chair, we have an open, what do I want to say? We pay for all of the drugs that that HCFA has allowed as being what medically effective. There are a few drugs that are excluded from coverage, but otherwise it's a wide open list. Over 100,000 individual drugs that are on the list that are updated constantly, and that's a part of what we use First Health to do, is to maintain that current listing of drugs. We also contract with PricewaterhouseCoopers, an actuarial firm, to develop our per capita costs and set our capitation rates. And we contract with the Oregon Medical Professional Review Organization to prior authorize some of our inpatient hospital stays for our fee-for-service clients. Then last item here in terms of efficiencies is we are using the internet and other electronic services. Our website is used. We put all of our provider guides and administrative rules on the website in order to cut down on the amount of printing and mailing to providers and interested parties. We encourage and facilitate electronic billing for providers, and currently we have 72% of our claims that are received and processed electronically, and we have available for providers a return electronic remittance device that will inform the provider about the disposition of his or her claim. On page 36, there's a chart that shows what we call HITS, the utilization, number of people accessing our website for information. And you can see that there in October and November, this is for the year 2000, the people were downloading information just following our annual revision of the provider guides at the rate of 80 to 90,000 a month. So it's utilized quite extensively. And that concludes our overview section.
Thank you. Kelly.
Oh, Madam Chair, yes. I did have one more page. I'm sorry. I skipped over page 37, if I could, just to give you, to reinforce that we do a significant amount of program coordination. We work closely with the Mental Health and Developmental Disability Services Division and the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs. Not only in terms of providing those benefits that are in our budget for our mutual clients, but wraparound services they provide. We work closely with Adult and Family Services Division, Senior and Disabled Services Division, and the State Office for Services to Children and Families, who do the eligibility determination for the Medicaid and CHIP programs. And then, since OMAP administers only a portion of Oregon's Oregon Health Plan, which is a broader health care reform strategy, we also coordinate closely with other entities outside of the department, and there is a list here of those entities. Thank you.
Thank you. Now, Kelly.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the subcommittee. For the record, Kelly Thrills with the Department of Administrative Services. And at this point in the presentation, the intent is for me to give a brief overview of the governor's budget, and then Hirsch and Lynn will provide more details before we on the phone. So with that, you should have a presentation document like this, hopefully that has my name on it. And I'm going to start with page 2. Frame this budget by saying a couple things. One, this is the largest human resource budget that will come before this subcommittee. I think it's the second largest budget that the legislature will hear outside of the school budget. This budget is a little under $3 billion total funds, $2,961 million. From a total from a general fund perspective, this budget that the governor is presenting is $869.9 million, which is a 36% increase. And when I mention that, one of the dubious distinctions this budget has is the fact that it is probably one of the most fast-growing budgets we have in state government for reasons we probably have discussed already and will discuss a little more in the future. On page 3, just provided you a quick reference of the funding sources, which we've talked about. Again, federal government participating in about 60% of the costs for this budget. As such, this is a Medicaid program, Medicaid resources primarily. As Peggy pointed out, general fund makes up a portion of the state resources that are matched with the federal payments, as well as tobacco tax and other funds. And primary sources of the other funds are like drug rebates, co-payments, and third-party recoveries. So that gives you some sense of the funding. Moving to page 4.
Madam Chairman.
Senator Harkin.
Kelly, you know, as I'm out and around talking to constituents and whatnot, why, you know, they ask about the $12.6 billion general fund budget for 2 years, and then also the number $33 billion comes up. And so on page 3, $8.4 billion total funds, that would relate to the 33, which is general fund revenue and other funds and federal funds, and would it not, or is...
Madam Chair, Senator Hartung, I believe the $33 billion that they're referring to is the total funds budget for state government,
yes,
which would include not only the general fund, but also federal resources and the other funds. It's the total resources for the state.
So it would be fair to say then the Department of Human Services consolidated budget, you say, here is $8.4 billion, and that's the proportion of the $33 billion of total funds.
The
of all of state government, not just the Department of Human Services.
Well, let me see if I can answer, Madam Chair. Go ahead if you have. If you can see what he's looking.
We're not talking about the whole department here, so I'm not sure what you're working.
We're just from.
I'm looking at this page 3.
Oh, okay, that's a different.
Was that my overview?
I think that was your.
That's what you were just talking about.
Dave.
With your name on it.
Two presentations. One was the overview for the entire department, which was in your book as of about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and then you should have a more recent document just for the Office of Medical Assistance Program.
Yeah, March 12th. Okay. So what does that say? Different.
Well, that says that about a third of the human resource budget is made up of this office, the Office of Medical Assistance Program.
One third of $8 billion.
One third of... I don't have the total.
More than a third.
$3 billion. Yeah, Peggy, if you could get those figures for me.
Yeah, I think that, let me see, I think my overview broke it out, and it seems to me like it was a third or close to it.
Yeah, it's about 32% of the human resource, from a general fund perspective, about 32% of the human resource budget is composed of the Oregon Health Plan.
Yes.
Human services.
Yes.
Okay.
From a total funds perspective, this budget makes up about 36% of the human resource, Department of Human Resources.
Department of Human Services.
Yeah.
Okay.
So, Madam Chair, let me move to page 4 of my overview.
Madam Chair, Sophie, under other funds, I asked the question of whether fines and penalties to providers are included in the other book. Is this a question you want to answer on the last day, or can you answer it now?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, all other funds revenue, with the exception of tobacco tax, show up under the other funds category, and if there is any overpayments or any other adjustments to a provider payment, that would show up under the other funds category, yes.
So does fines and penalties to the providers, are they included in other funds?
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, we are getting the actual dollar amounts of that information for you now. The other fund budget is, if we set aside the amount that's tobacco tax, most of the other fund budget is drug rebates, overpayments that we collect from providers, There are occasionally situations where we fine a provider if we have warned them repeatedly in the past about inappropriate billing practices and they continue to do it. Then we collect an additional recovery, and I don't know whether you would call that a fine or not, but it's very rare. Probably the most frequent situation where we get money into our other fund budget that you might consider to be something like a fine is directly from the Department of Justice, where the Medicaid Fraud Unit has either convicted somebody of Medicaid fraud or has entered into a negotiated settlement with an individual. And in those cases, sometimes we get money into our budget that you probably could characterize as penalties, but it's most frequently as a result of a fraud conviction.
And that's included in, Madam Chair, this is included in your other funds.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that's correct.
Madam Chair.
Senator Duncan.
I'm just curious to follow through. You mentioned the ESDs at one point. It was $10 billion, as I understand, went from your administrative fund to ESDs, and they reimbursed you back $5 million. Is that going back into where is that going back into your...
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, it actually doesn't show up anywhere, because when we make that initial payment to the ESD of $10 million, that is made up of $5 million of general fund money and $5 million of federal fund money. And they turn around and simply refund the general fund piece back to us. So we pay out five, we get back five.
I'm sure there's a reason.
Should I clarify that? Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, it's an accounting process, but it does show up in our other funds budget. When we make our payment out of $5 million federal funds, $5 million general funds, then we get $5 million in as other funds. That's a direct offset to the general funds. So our budget doesn't show that we made the $5 million general fund payment, but it shows that we have the $5 million other funds to cover that part of the payment. So it is in the other funds bucket.
Thank you.
That's right.
Madam Chair, let me proceed on page 4 of the document. On page 4 is just a real brief synopsis of what the governor's budget contains, some of the assumptions we used. First of all, there's an assumption that the Oregon Health Plan eligibles as a total group will increase about 5.5%. Some categories will go up higher, some categories go up lower, but overall about a 5.5% growth. Second of all, talking more about the costs in the Oregon Health Plan, I've been through this at least once with this subcommittee, the fact that the overall cost budget is going up about 20%, and the factors leading up to that primarily relate to drug costs increasing 61%. And we're going to talk more specifically about the reasons for that later on in the presentation. You move to page 5. This budget does include three areas where reductions were made. One is that the CPI for certain fee-for-service providers were cut in half. Rather than receiving a CPI growth of 4.6% in their payments, would be reduced down to 2.3%. We're also taking about three different drug management actions in order to reduce this budget, and we're also reducing funding for some Type B hospitals.
Mr. Madam Chair.
Sure. Boy, they both said the same time. Senator Duncan and then...
You may be asking the same question. Go ahead. Oh, Senator Duncan, okay. Reduce the funding for the Type B hospitals. Would you... Oh, thank you. It's so nice to be with my own kind down here.
Yes, right. I look happy.
Reducing the funding for Type B hospitals. Would you explain that? Why? I visit some of those hospitals.
Yeah, let me give you an overview of it, and if we get into too much detail, I'll turn to Hirsch to give the more specific answer. My understanding is we have about, well, Type B hospitals are those with fewer than 50 beds and within 30 miles of another acute hospital. And we have about 19 of those hospitals statewide. If you would, and the intent was that these were smaller hospitals that needed financial help, and so we'd pay the full cost of services to those hospitals. And if you look over the past two, 3 or 4 years, and you look at the financial status of these hospitals, roughly about 3/4 of them have a fairly strong financial status as opposed to the situation in the past, and about 1/4 still needed financial help. So the intention behind this action was to move away from fully financing those 3/4 of the hospitals that had a strong financial picture but still provide a financial help for those 1/4 that did not have as good a financial situation. And the intent was to, through, I think it was Senate Bill 435, to get together a group of individuals to determine what the correct mechanism was to allocate these resources so that the hospitals that needed the resources would still get the extra help, but we wouldn't be reimbursing as highly those other hospitals. That's my short answer, Senator.
Continue, just a second.
Follow up.
Do you have, you did I understand you say 19?
I believe there are 19, Senator.
19 hospitals. It's possible that I could see that list at some point. That must not be right at the moment, but I like to see
absolutely.
It. I mean, I was at Hepner, and some of those were enterprise where they're just hanging on. In fact, whatever we do with the health plan looks like that will determine whether or not they survive, almost, as I understand.
Madam Chair, Senator Duncan, you're correct. We'll be glad to get you the list of those hospitals. But as Mr. Friels pointed out, not all of the Type B hospitals are necessarily in financial trouble, and not all of them are rural hospitals. Many of them have fairly low utilization rates simply because the people who live in those communities where the hospitals are get their health care services from physicians who practice and hospitalize patients in hospitals in nearby communities. And so the Type B hospitals in some cases have low utilization rates and high cost as a result of that. And as Kelly pointed out, the process that is envisioned in Senate Bill 435 would be to establish some criteria by an independent body that would then be used to identify those Type B hospitals for whom cost-based reimbursement should continue. And then that criteria would go to the Office of Rural Health, and they would apply it to the group of Type B hospitals and identify hospitals where we would continue cost-based reimbursement.
Madam Chair, I guess the one of the concerns I have as we talk about the rural health and rural hospitals and so forth, as we talk about the One Oregon concept and so forth, healthcare is a primary concern out there. And if we're really trying to spread people around so we don't everybody moving to the city, I think it's important that they have a viable access to the church. So I think that's one of the reasons that our committee, as we traveled around, we really became very aware of those needs and why we really want to do everything we can to maintain those hospitals. You know, if Hepner loses a hospital, that people move out, they get away, because they want to be near health care, and so you need to have good access. So it really, it is a problem that people in the metropolitan area need to be concerned about. It is not just a rural health problem.
Representative Schrader.
A question on the CPI reductions. What is the 2.3 represent, what does the 4.6 represent, dollar-wise?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, a full 4.6% would represent, from a general fund perspective, about $4.4 million. So we cut that in half, so there's a savings of $2.2 million as a result of going from the 4.6% inflationary rate to the 2.3. Let me continue on.
Peggy, and then I'll let you.
No, Madam Chair, that's okay. I was just going to answer the question that it's on page 9, the detailed dollars on those issues.
Okay, thank you.
Senator, you? Thank you. Madam Chair, well, I don't understand, why do we cut the CPI for fee-for-service to half when we are concerned that in the rural areas there may be less access? Because a lot of the managed care providers have left. So we depend heavily on fee-for-service. And now you cut them in half, the excess will be even less
and then with Hospital B not getting funded, I think the rural community will be at risk of having no providers.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, that's a very good point. I think the real answer to that question is being in a very tough financial situation that we're in right now, and we've had to make a number of cuts during the governor's budget that were very difficult to make, and if resources were available, we would not have made these cuts. And we made other cuts in the human resource program that we definitely want to add back if resources became available, and this might fall into that category also, but given the limited resources, we had to make reductions in throughout state government, and this was one of the difficult choices we made.
So this is, Madam Chair, so this is $2.2 million that we can add back if funding is available.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, given where we are with the March revenue forecast, where it is down, I think, over $100 million from what the governor's budget was, I guess we're looking at how we balance the governor's budget within what he asked for originally. The idea of adding back resources really hasn't been something we've been looking at this particular time, trying to maintain the programs that we had in the original governor's budget.
That's wise.
Yeah. Okay, Kelly.
Madam Chair, I'm still on page 5. I just wanted to bring up the cigarette tax. The fact that the governor's budget does assume that the cigarette tax, the 10-cent tax, would continue. It's scheduled to sunset January of 2002. The governor's budget assumes that it would continue. If it didn't continue, I have a list of programs that the governor would propose to reduce. Moving to page 6, again, it's already been pointed out, the Oregon Health Plan. If you look at the program structure of the Office of Medical Assistance Program, it's primarily the Oregon Health Plan. As first pointed out, the non-Oregon health plan piece is 6%, administration makes up 3%, and the children's health insurance program makes up 1% of the program. And then on page 7, you can again see how special payments or payments out to clients make up the vast majority of this budget. If you look at personal services and services supply, that makes up 3%. The total fund budget, 97% are payments that go out to providers for health care services. And then on page 8, as we typically do, just going down through the building blocks that the governor used to develop this budget, again, we looked at the rebalance plans that took place in December 99 and April of 2000 and building the governor's budget, and the final rebalance plan in November of 2000 was used as the final adjustment to develop the governor's recommended budget. I think Peggy pointed out in her presentation that the department is in the process right now of relooking at the budget for this biennium, 99-01, and with changing assumptions this biennium, they will reshoot or reforecast what their financial needs are for the next biennium, 2001-2003, which they will bring to you later in the process. In looking at current service level, I guess as been pointed out, about a fourth of the growth in this budget is due to eligible increases. About three-fourths of the growth in this budget from the last biennium to this biennium is as a result of cost growth, again, that 20% cost growth. And then if you look on page 9, this just identifies all those policy packages above the current service level budget. Again, we point out the three actions the governor took to reduce expenditures, which we've already talked about, and then two other packages. One, package 401, is to add staff in order to facilitate the workload that the Office of Medical Assistance has right now. We have been moving toward a managed care environment. Because of circumstances, not every place in Oregon can have a managed care environment. As a result, we're having more of the clients represented through a fee-for-service payment system, and they do not have the staff in order to make these payments in an expeditious way, and so they're asking for, I think, 16 staff to fully pay for, to facilitate the payment of those fee-for-service claims.
Just a question when you were going through the fee-for-service workload increase, and you've reduced the amount of CPI, which I want to follow up on Senator Yee's concern that we may be increasing the amount of staff to process, but if we reduce the amount of payment to the provider, will we continue to have the providers out there and have nobody to provide the service? I'm kind of wondering now, when you look at these issues and you're setting the priorities, you know, granted you have to have somebody to process, but if you don't have anybody out there to serve, kind of like a chicken and the egg situation.
Madam Chair, this was a very tough decision to make as far as deciding what the correct balance was of what programs to cut in order to live within the resources the governor had to live with. And I can say that reducing the CPI in half was one of the last cuts that were made, recognizing that there was a real access issue out in the community.
What's our dollar amount for the 16 positions?
I think that's about $400,000, General Fund, Madam Chair.
Representative Schrader.
How much money do we spend on outreach, and how much of it is general fund, if any?
Madam Chair, Representative Schrader, most of the outreach for the Oregon Health Plan is done as a result of making applications for the health plan and also for the CHIP program more available to people. We have about 130 sites throughout the state, such locations as county health departments, hospitals, WIC clinics, family planning clinics, tribal clinics, federally qualified health centers, rural health clinics, where you can get an application for the health plan and where somebody can help you fill it out. Our only cost for those facilities is simply getting the applications out there. We don't actually pay for the staff.
Madam Chair, let me continue on page 9. Package 410 and 411 are just the packages necessary to add the resources back into the budget to continue the 10-cent cigarette tax. On page 10, kind of a throwaway page, it just identifies that the revenue changes we have are the cigarette tax. And then page 11 just points out that there will be some technical adjustments made to this budget. They could come from two different sources. One, changes that the governor may make in his revised budget, but more importantly, as a result of the April rebalance or reshoot process where the department is reassessing their budget for this biennium and for the 9901 biennium and the changes that may take place as a result of that new information.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, there's another change that I left out of my points and Kelly left out of his as well, and that is that after the governor's budget was put together, there was a revised federal match rate change.
Oh. Yeah.
And that creates a shortfall of about $8
million.
The budget is built on a match rate of 59.5, and I think the actual match rate that came down is 59.34. And so that equates it, when you spread that through the entire Department of Human Services budget, that's an $8 million change. I'm not sure how much it is in OMAP in particular, but for the agency overall.
Yes, PG.
Well, Madam Chair, that's kind of an indication of this budget, how volatile it is. Very small changes in small federal changes amount to large general fund impact. I think that was a point that Hirsch was making earlier that we continually want to reinforce. That's the end of my presentation. If you have any more questions, Madam Chair.
Okay. Senator, Madam Chair, Kelly, what is the funding for the MMIS update
or replacement or whatever you're called.
Madam yes. Chair, Senator Yee, when you say the funding, overall, let me give you the big answer. There is an expectation that the total project's going to cost probably someplace between $100 and $150 million over three or four biennia. Most of the costs have a 90% federal match, and so the feds will pay close to 90% of that cost. The state will pay 10% of that cost. I don't remember specifically in the director's office budget, there is a package for the next phase or the costs of MMIS for the 0103, and I think that's a little over between $2 and $3 million of general fund is what would be asked for to continue this project. I think more importantly, Madam Chair, Senator Yee, is this is probably a placeholder amount of money until we actually have the consultants' findings of what's needed and different options available to implement this change or update of the system. We really won't know what the full cost is or the amount of time or the options available to actually make the change to the MMIS system or update it.
Follow up, Madam Chair. So there will be $2 to $3 million available for this system in the director's office.
Madam Chair, Senator Yee, $2 to $3 million of general fund, mm-hmm. understanding that most of the money is going to be a federal match. And that you will hear more about that particular budget when the director's office comes forward in a couple, 3 weeks.
Thank you. I'm sorry, we had a sidebar.
Oh, that's fine, Madam Chair. It's close to 10:30. I don't know whether you want to continue with
If you have completed your budget summary overview, then we will save the get into back into detail program discussion tomorrow, unless there's some further questions from members of the committee. If not, we stand adjourned.
Thank you, Madam Chair.